It's Monday, November 13th, 2017, and you're listening to Inquiring Minds. I'm Indra Viscontis. Kishore Hari is off this week as he wraps up the Bay Area Science Festival. If you want to attend any of their events, well, I guess it's too late. But you can find out more at bayareascience.org. Each week, we bring you a new in-depth exploration of the space where science, politics, and society collide. We endeavor to find out what's true, what's left to discover, and why it all matters. You can find us online at inquiring.show, on Twitter at inquiringshow, and on Facebook. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes or any other podcasting app. Looking for fun trivia to impress your family and friends this holiday season? Look no further. Since 1987, Portable Press has provided facts and trivia to those who crave it with the Uncle John's Bathroom Reader series. Not only will you be entertained, but you'll know a whole lot more about the world around you. Just go to portablepress.com/minds to download a 20-page free sample of the new 30th anniversary title, Uncle John's Old Faithful Bathroom Reader. Or follow them on social media at Portable Press for more trivia and frequent book giveaways. As many of you know, I have a background in neuroscience, and I'm always interested in finding out what is at the cutting edge of the field. This summer, I went to the meeting of the Organization for Human Brain Mapping and found out about some really cool work being done scanning brains, not just of kids, but of fetuses. And I wanted to talk to the person who does that. Mariah Thomason is a pediatric neuroscientist at Wayne State University in Detroit, and she is a pioneer at brain imaging fetuses. Why, might you ask? Should we image the brains of fetuses as they're still developing and they have yet to be born? Well, the answer is that we might be able to find out about not only how their development is going, but whether or not they are at risk at developing problems after birth. And maybe we can even go in and solve some of those solutions ultimately before they're born. So let's take a short break, and we'll be back with my interview with Mariah Thomason. Are you a dinner party host looking for a foolproof way to get perfect meats, poultry, and fish? With Joule Sous Vide, every home cook can create chef-level dishes thanks to precise temperature control. Joule makes sure your food will never over or undercook, so you're free to focus on your guests or whip up some amazing sides. There are more than 100 recipes in the video-rich Joule app to help you cook almost every protein, from meat to poultry to fish to eggs, plus desserts, veggies, and more. And if your guests are running late or your apps and cocktails are taking you longer than expected, it's not a problem. Joule is ready when you are. Your food won't overcook. Joule, perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Joule and use the code MINDS to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/Joule, code MINDS. Mariah Thomason, welcome to Inquiring Minds.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I was so excited to hear about your work from a friend of mine at the Organization for Human Brain Mapping conference. And I, you know, it was the first time I'd come across it. And I'm so fascinated even just to hear about the nuts and bolts of how you do it. So how is it that you started to do neuroimaging of fetuses?
So, you know, it's interesting. It's not really an advance in the technology itself. There wasn't some massive methodological breakthrough that opened up this new window. In fact, it was actually the way that we think about data and the way that we use data that has changed a lot within the field of functional MRI over the past several years. And the transition that happened was that really the paradigm had been to perform task-based fMRI, so functional MRI, where you present a stimulus to the participant and you look at how areas of the brain respond to that stimulus. And then when you analyze the data, you're basically asking the data which parts of the brain lit up when we presented the stimulus of interest. And so the data that we showed, those blobs on brains that you saw in all of those publications over the years, were pictures of areas that were activated during a task. But we know that the brain is active all of the time. And so what really changed in our thinking was how to deal with that. And so what happened was a researcher put an individual in the scanner. This was Bharat Biswal, actually quite a number of years ago. And he asked that person to just remain completely still. And he measured signals from the brain in the absence of a task. So brain function, just doing what the brain does at rest. And what he showed was that regions of the motor system are talking to each other all of the time. He was able to take the signal out of the left motor cortex, correlate it with what was happening all over the brain, and the result that emerged was a perfect map of the entire motor system. So this was a picture of a system, even though the person was remaining entirely still. And so what that did is it sort of opened a door up, and it actually took us a long time to open this door as researchers, to the fact that we could extract from the brain, even when the person wasn't doing a task, neural systems, not just the motor system, but other sensory motor systems, higher order cognitive systems. We could do this without presenting a stimulus to the subject. So that brings us back to your original question, which is, you know, how did you get into the fetus? Well, obviously the fetus for many reasons is encased inside of another human being, so we can't easily present stimulus. So this opened up an opportunity to look at spontaneous signals coming out of the fetal brain and to map the neural connectional architecture of those functional systems across fetal development.
And so how does it physically work? I mean, I've been in an fMRI scanner a number of times, and I've been pregnant, and I'm just trying to put the physics of those two things together. Can you describe what it's like?
Yeah, well, first, it's really beautiful. I mean, the idea that we're able to create another human inside of our body is pretty phenomenal. And also these moms are pretty extraordinary as well. But it's not really that different. A mom will go into the MRI machine. Unlike when you went in, she'll go in feet first and we'll get her really comfortable. We're talking a lot of extra padding and pillows because pregnancy isn't all too comfortable and putting yourself in a machine. Our machine's a little bit bigger, in terms of the bore size. So they're able to be a little bit more comfortable. They can lay on whatever side's comfortable. You kind of have to be dynamic and flexible in a way that you're not in a standard MRI. You know, once you go into a typical MRI, people say, don't move, stay still. In our case, we do want the lady to stay still where we're scanning, but if she wants to make any kind of adjustments throughout the protocol, we'll shift her, we'll move her. If the signal's not good, we'll rearrange her. This is not the same in that regard. And the coil that we use is just a really lightweight, bendable, flexible, non-threatening looking. It's kind of like styrofoamy looking. We just put it around her belly. We put a bunch of padding around that. It's honestly really not that different. It's an abdominal coil that just rests lightly on her torso.
And so, you know, one of the main difficulties of putting anyone in the scanner is that they have to stay still. And so how does that work for a fetus?
So despite my best attempts, I'm not able to ask the fetus to remain still. But we do know that from doing this work, and I have to say, when I started years ago, I had no idea what to expect. There weren't that many people doing this kind of work. And I just thought, who knows? Who knows what we're going to find? But now that I've done it for six years, I know that the fetus alternates between periods of quiescence and periods of movement. I know that some fetuses are going to give a really good signal just because of the position that they're in, or the amount of space that they have, or even interactions with the organs of the mother around the fetus can cause different susceptibility in our images. So we get a lot of variation, and we really don't know at the moment that we put a lady into the scanner what it is that we're going to see. But because it's functional MRI, we're able to take and gather more data than we need. And basically what we do is we throw away the times when the fetus is moving. So, and it turns out that that's about half of our data. So if I acquire, let's say, 20 minutes of resting state data, just letting the brain spontaneously do what it's doing in the fetus, I'm going to expect to retain about 10 minutes in which the fetus was very still. And that's very usable data.
And so one more sort of technical question before you tell us what you're finding. How old generally are the fetuses that you're looking at?
When we started, we scanned as young as 18 weeks. But really, after doing this for a while, I really feel that the value and most of what we're going to discover is going to come from the third trimester of pregnancy, because the brain is just frankly bigger at that point. The vascular system, which is what our signals are based on, is more mature. My sense at this point, without, you know, enough people doing this research to really know concretely, is that we probably are going to have findings that are most meaningful, meaning findings that are best able to tell us about the future health of that individual brain over the life course are probably going to come from later stages of development, both because what the brain is doing in terms of modeling and remodeling at that time are probably more indicative of long-term system function, and because our measurements are probably just better able to do what we need them to do at that time.
So tell us a little bit about what you found so far.
Initially the work was centered on being able to be sure that the signals that we were measuring were in fact meaningful, because we don't have proof of concept or gold standard for functional systems of the fetal brain, because until now we haven't had a method for measuring function. Most of what we knew about the fetal brain development came from postmortem research or from pictures, anatomical pictures. So, if you open a window into this previous black box and you have a technique and that technique has, errors and unknowns, you really just have to really first establish that in principle that it works. And so our first findings were really to demonstrate that in utero, we could measure functional systems by replicating what we knew should be true over development, such as the fact that we should see increases in cross-hemispheric connectivity between the right and left side, between homologous structures that would increase in strength with advancing age, right? The brain is becoming wired up. The corpus callosum that connects the two hemispheres is developing. Communication is increasing. Those types of things were sort of the first findings, because we needed to sort of establish the methodology. Once we got past that, a lot of what we've done is to ask ourselves, are there high order functional systems and motor systems and sensory systems, and how are these developing? And what we find is what you would expect is an increase in initially local connectivity. So those branches are building themselves out. And then across gestational development, you begin to see the long-range connections that we know will exist later. And it almost seems that what we're seeing is that the brain is initially kind of connecting up to everybody. So beginning locally, spreading distally. And probably what maturation across fetal life looks like is a lot of outgrowth. The pruning processes really are not taking place until that beginning birth transition, which is also not surprising because we know from neonatal imaging that a lot of those pruning processes are happening in the first years. It really seems like gestation is a time where you're just making a lot of connections. And it kind of makes sense neurobiologically because we know that there are a lot of shifts in the chemical signaling across the birth transition. And we also know that the environment is radically different. I mean, what a brain needs to do when it's in a mom versus out in the world is very different. So it seems that it would be a smart way to design a brain to have the processes of growth being very rampant during this time with minimal input, although I do think environment does play a big role, and then to let this sort of the early environment begin to shape that more as you interact and learn. I mean, babies learn. They learn really rapidly.
Yeah, and I think anyone who has taken a baby on a long haul flight can just, it would just be terrible if that same very same baby in that same developmental stage was like inside the womb, like that. That baby would be so bored in this environment. Another thing that kind of this brings up for me is, to what extent do you see individual variability? I mean, are you seeing that fetuses tend to be pretty similar compared with babies or adults? I mean, certainly we see a lot of variability in functional activation in the adult brain. There's a big push towards looking at individual differences. How similar are fetuses?
Well, we see lots of variation in fetal brain development, which is meaningful and maybe not altogether surprising. Some of the things that our group has found is that fetuses that will go on to be born preterm have reduced or diminished connectivity, particularly in what appears to be somewhat a left lateral language region, a region that will later support language function. And this weaker connectivity prior to preterm delivery was correlated with how long they gestated. So those fetuses that had a longer gestational course, even though they were preterm, all of the cases I'm talking about right now are preterm, their gestational course, those that were born closer to their due date had connectivity that looked more like the control comparison fetuses. Another thing that we found.
So sorry, let me stop you there for a second. Yeah. Even early on. So like you're saying at, 6 or 7 months, you can predict on the basis of brain activity, whether that baby will be born preterm. That seems shocking to me.
it's a really exciting finding, I think, because we have long thought. I mean, we see differences. Children that are born preterm demonstrate, are three to five times more likely to demonstrate developmental problems. Rates of autism, ADHD are much higher in these children. Language delays. We know that they have these neurodevelopmental concerns, and for many years we've thought, that these probably originate in utero. So the study was exciting because it demonstrated for the first time that in fact the brain does seem to be developing differently in those fetuses that will be born preterm. And I'm not going to point a finger at sort of causality because we're really performing correlation in these studies. But I will say that I think that whatever it is that is the ontological or etiological process that's going to lead to preterm delivery, a major candidate being inflammation, probably is influencing both the gestational course and neurological or central nervous system development. And in terms of what you asked, which is about prediction, we're really careful to say that we're able to predict. I'm very hesitant to say something like that because it's leaps and bounds, I think, from how we're going to apply this tool. I have different ideas about, the meaning or how we can use this translationally. But it does tell us maybe who amongst these cases maybe is at higher risk. So, a mom can demonstrate clinical symptoms that suggest she's going to deliver early, a short cervix, certainly premature rupture of the membranes. But the additional information that we see about brain development may coach us on early interventions. And even in utero, there's new data demonstrating that you can change brain development by what you expose the fetus to in utero. And I do mean human fetuses.
So it's like possible that there's something related to what nutrients the fetus is receiving from, the mother, or what the environmental conditions are. Is it like that? Or is it sort of the mother's stress level? So hormone changes. Do we have any idea of, how these kinds of variables interact with fetal brain development?
I think we will very soon. I mean, the technique is so new, but these are the dreams. These are the motivations. This is why we started this kind of a project and why I hope a lot of other groups start working in this area, because for so many years as developmental scientists, we've said, we know that probably that prenatal period is playing such an important role in shaping brain development. And we've had to kind of nod our heads to it because we don't have access to that time point. But I think now we do. One of our most recent studies that has not yet been published looked at the association between prenatal stress, which we absolutely believe has effects on child development. And we know this because women who are experienced prenatal stress have children that go on to manifest much higher behavioral problems, challenges in school, ADHD, and dysregulation of their stress response systems physiologically. But we haven't been able to see whether that risk is transferred in utero. And the study that we did looked at 47 moms, assessed them across a number of stress domains, depression, anxiety across pregnancy. This was a highly stressed demographic group, primarily low resource, urban, minority women, many unpartnered. And what we found was that the neural connectivity, the signature of global neural architecture, was different. I'm not sure. I'm hesitant to say exactly what it was because it's an unpublished result. But the fetuses of mothers that were highly stressed had strong differences in total connectional properties than did the non-stressed counterparts.
This really sort of turns on its head a lot of the sort of layperson's view that so much of a child's, behaviors and sort of brain development, brain function, comes from genetics if we can see those changes already at birth. But even though we know like the uterine environment has an effect, I think it's been largely set aside as either we don't understand how big an effect or surely it can't be that big an effect because most babies turn out okay. And it's like there's this whole push to, alleviate mothers of some guilt of like, you know, every time you eat the donut, you know, are you making your child more likely to have diabetes later? But, you know, it's interesting to me to think that maybe in some ways, as we learn what are these conditions during the gestational period, that might give us a sense, too, of how much of the child's later behavior and development and so forth is genetic versus environmental, although obviously it's hard to tease those two things apart.
Yeah, and room for optimism. because if we, you know, if we can see that we can have an effect, then certainly there's room for improvement. We can start thinking about this time and how to care for women and what the best practices are. So that's exciting. You know, if we hadn't thought of this as the first environment, we couldn't do much about it. Also, what regions we find differences in give us a hint. They give us a clue. They allow us to generate new hypotheses about what, you know, how those stress functions, how those stress systems are in fact affecting which specific neural pathways, right? So that's insight. That's insight into the mechanistic pathways.
So can you describe some of those and any of those specific findings that, you know, have you found any correlations that are sort of surprising in their precision?
Yeah, a couple of surprising findings, one in the posterior cingulate gyrus and one in the cerebellum. So the posterior cingulate gyrus results is really interesting because we think of this as an important component of what's called the default mode network of the brain. The default mode network is your mind wandering network. It's a network of the brain that's really important for introspective thinking, rumination, kind of the day-to-day activities of your brain when your brain's not being told exactly what to do. You're not deploying attention for some high demanding cognitive task.
So can we just pause and sort of define the difference between sort of resting state connectivity and default mode network for our listeners?
Yeah, for sure. So the default mode network is a set of regions comprised of the posterior cingulate, medial prefrontal regions, some parietal regions. And essentially, this is a set of areas that is very active when you're not deeply focused. But what's very interesting is that when you do deploy attentionally demanding resources, this area quiets down. So this is different from resting state. Resting state refers to just what the brain does all of the time, which includes all of the brain. So every bit of your brain is active all of the time, despite what you were once told about only using 13% of your brain. The brain, that's not true at all. The brain is always doing what it does. But this is a particular network within the brain, just like a visual network or an auditory network, a set of regions that's highly connected to one another that serves a function. And it seems that, you know, we all have that experience of, you know, reading a book, for example, and you realize that you stopped reading quite a while ago, your mind has wandered off the page. We have these probably really important processes that we all understand to be true through experience, where our brain sort of has its own agenda. And I think that the default mode network is kind of that agenda. And it's actually, you know, really important for health and disease and cognitive function, because if this negative tension between cognitive control regions and the default mode network breaks down, we see that happening in neurological disorders, and we see it's associated with cognitive ability. So therefore, it's behaviorally relevant. So anyways, we're built this way. We're set up with this system that's very important for, let's say, taking a break, but it's not at all taking a break. It's doing something that's essential for human cognition. And what we found was this negative opposition between the PCC and other brain regions is already present in the fetus and increases with fetal age. And the reason that that's surprising is because I think that we have, in a way, anthropomorphized the fetal brain to say, well, hey, the fetus doesn't need to do anything high order, so why would it need those systems? Most of what we talk about in early development has to do with maturation of sensory motor systems prior to maturation of high order cognitive systems, which we certainly think of this as being. And I think that what this finding tells us is that perhaps brain areas don't know that they're destined for greatness. They don't know that I'm going to be really important high order. They just are following these very long, very essential genetically based programs. And maybe the establishment of the PCC and its negative connectivity, sorry, the posterior cingulate and its connectivity to other brain regions is in fact formative to the total establishment of neural architecture. And so that was a really exciting finding to me. It's one that I want to pursue because I think it allows us to maybe think differently about, you know, how the brain is developing and how the brain developing gives us insight into its overall organization.
Yeah, sort of this sense that, you know, we have the building blocks for what will become uniquely human, or we think of as uniquely human functions. And, you know, not only, you know, for me, I always like seeing not only this the sort of building blocks of this in human development, but also in other species. You know, so it sort of gives us a sense of also where we came from, of like how, you know, Mother Nature, natural selection, like tinkered up systems from other species that maybe, you know, weren't so critical for what is different in a human being's experience.
Absolutely true. Because you can ask yourself, well, why is it like that? You can say, you know, why does this animal preserve this area across, you know, and like, for example, the olfactory bulb, it's huge in many rodents. I mean, and it's guiding behavior. And as humans, we don't really think of that sense as being critical, but I think olfactory development is probably one of our earliest navigational systems. So it gives us a hint, just like you're saying, this is a critical system because it's so critical across species. The second area I was going to point out to you is the cerebellum. And that's another one of those, you know, preserved across species evolutionary systems. Why do we have this cerebellum? Why do we have this little brain that sticks off of the back of our big brain? And it's another area where we see differences as a function of the experience of the mom in the fetus. And I think that that's really telling us something important about the role of the cerebellum.
Yeah, I feel like the cerebellum is like this like mysterious thing that, you know, we were taught, you know, in early neuroanatomy, oh, it's just about fine motor timing. It's just about, you know, hand-eye kind of coordination stuff. Like, you know, it allows you to do these fine movements. And then you realize through years of studying neuroimaging papers that it's like activated in everything, right?
Yeah.
Like it
yeah.
seems to have a role, like a functional role in so many different aspects of what our brains do and what they're for. So yeah, to me, it feels like, and yet like we ignore it so often, like, oh, it's just this like, you know, lower, almost like barely brainstem kind of like uninteresting thing.
Yeah, I'm definitely rooting for the cerebellum.
Yeah, so I guess that gets me to this question of, can you see kind of any task-related, or have you tried to look for task-related activation in fetuses? You know, we hear often there's, you know, obviously there's huge interest in how to build a better baby, right? And so there's this huge industry of like, oh, you know, play Mozart to your fetus, and that fetus is more likely to have a higher IQ. You know, we know that those are myths, but what have you seen any kind of or have you looked at all at kind of task-related activation, and has that given you any insights?
So my group probably won't pursue those types of studies, and I'll tell you why. It really is because I don't think it's easy to control stimulus presentation to a fetus. And certainly groups have done that, but imagine, for example, that you're putting sound and you're putting it on the abdomen of the mom. You take an MRI picture, you check the fetal head position, but maternal adiposity could differ, alertness of the fetus during the application could differ. There are a lot of reasons that that's an unconstrained study. But I think what you could do, and what I would be interested in doing, is you could have a treatment condition. So you could have fetuses that you play the Mozart for across, you know, 6 weeks. And we know neural plasticity is very rapid. And then you could look at sort of the before after. You could look at, you know, SSRIs during pregnancy. You could look at, and I think those sort of those environmental prolonged exposure studies, I think those are going to be the really interesting ones. Just for the reason I said, it's very hard to control stimulus presentation. I'm not saying I wouldn't do it. I'm just saying that I would do it trying to exert the best control that I could under a situation that's hard to control.
Yeah, and the sort of clinical trial approach seems to me, yeah, much more interesting too, because it's more akin to what would be happening in the outside world, outside of the lab. But I wonder about, you know, how difficult it would be to get compliance amongst your participants, since, you know, any mother, you know, is motivated to create the best environment possible for their fetus. And so, like, if they knew they were in a study in which they couldn't play Mozart, but I don't know, you know, it was like, well, how would the control arm react? Would they comply with the, you know, with the instructions?
Yeah. Like, well, you know, clinical studies have had to deal with that. You know, it's much more serious when you have a child and there's like a cancer therapy and you get put in the control group, right? This is easy. This is music. So I think other groups have worked out how to deal with that. You usually offer an alternative, or you end up putting them in the treatment group. Either way, you just do it in they're their own control or something like that.
You can stagger them
exactly.
And so forth.
Yeah. We don't keep them away from opportunity, for sure.
So do you have any directions that you hope to go in the near future that we should look out for in terms of headline making studies that are going to come out of your lab?
Well, hopefully bunches, but the thing that we're working on right now is better understanding the role of inflammation. I mentioned it earlier because I do think that, you know, epidemiological studies, preclinical studies, that would be animal studies, show us that inflammation can play a major role in central nervous system development, even below, you know, what you would think of. It's not that a mom has to get, you know, really sick or deal with a serious illness during pregnancy, but just you have an immune system and this immune system is working for you all of the time. And the way that our immune systems work, each individually, they even, you know, I once heard a quote about, you know, an immune system is the only other system of the body that has a memory, you know, other than the brain. And it's so true. It's a map. It's a map of our longitudinal health. And the fetal immune system gets its first start in the womb. But we haven't really had a good way to measure fetal immune system function, because immune system function is really just measured in the mom, her peripheral blood, or, you know, we can take samples from the fetus or the placenta, the umbilical cord at the time that the fetus is born. But that doesn't really tell you about the gestational story. And so my group is working to find ways to better understand not just maternal inflammation during pregnancy, but fetal inflammation, activation of the fetal immune system, and how that's associated with neurological development. This is really important because epidemiological studies show us that children and even adults that were exposed to inflammation in utero experience higher rates of autism and schizophrenia. I told you it also can lead to preterm delivery. I think there's a really important story developing around immune function.
That's so interesting. I look forward to learning more about it. Mariah Thomason, thank you so much for being on Inquiring Minds.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
So that's it for another episode. Kishore will be back next week. I want to thank you for joining us for this installment of Inquiring Minds. And we'd also like to thank our supporters on our Patreon campaign, especially David Noel, Clark Lindgren, Stefan Meyer Ewald, Michael Galgul, Kyle Raihala, Joel, Jonathan Worsley, Yushi Lin, Eric Clark, Jordan Millar, Herring Chen, Sean Johnson, and Nick Cadillac. You can visit our website at inquiring.show, and you can support us at patreon.com/inquiringminds. You can also find us on Twitter at Inquiring Show and Facebook, and you can send us comments, feedback, future guest ideas, pictures of you when you were just a fetus, or anything else you'd like to contact@inquiring.show. Inquiring Minds is produced by Adam Isaac in cooperation with The Climate Desk, a journalistic collaboration in partnership with many media outlets. Our music is provided by award-winning producer Rian Sheehan. And I'm your host, Indre Viscontis. You can find me on Twitter at IndreVis. See you next week. Great cooking is part art, part science. Jules Sous Vide takes care of the science, cooking meat, fish, and poultry to perfection with precise temperature control. Jewel, perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Jewel and use the code MINDS to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/JOULE, code MINDS.